For more than 30 years, neurobiologist Dr. Kevin Nelson researched the borderlands of consciousness. And tonight on Coast to Coast, he will share his work, his research, with the spiritual doorway in the brain. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Kevin Nelson, world-renowned neurologist, and has devoted decades to the study of near-death experiences. Professor of neurology at the University of Kentucky, and a recognized authority on the neurological processes of spiritual sensation. He offers an answer to that question that we're all looking for that is beyond what any scientist has previously encountered on the borderlands of consciousness. And in his research, Dr. Nelson has discovered that spiritual experiences take place in one of the primitive areas of the brain. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Dr. Kevin Nelson. Hey, Kevin, how are you?
I'm doing fine, George, and I'm very pleased to be with you.
Me too. I'm looking forward to this. This is exciting for all of us. You know, this is something we've studied and talked about for years, and here you are out there working away for 30-plus years on this. How'd this all happen?
Well, you know, like many physicians, I came to my interest in this through my patients, you know, and I had, when I was very young, actually, a beginning intern, I had one of the most influential and profound patient encounters I ever had in my life. I just moved from Michigan and to New Mexico, where I was doing my internship. And very early on, within weeks or so, I had a patient by the name of Joe Hernandez. And he came to me one day after he'd been discharged from the hospital. And he was all excited. And he had in his hand a painting that he had made. And while he was in the hospital, he was in the ICU and was very ill. And frankly, we didn't think he was going to make it. But he pulled through. But in this painting, he had done something and portrayed something that had happened to him. And within the painting itself, he was lying in bed, fully awake, and at the foot of his bed, the devil and Jesus were battling for his soul.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was very stark. And intravenous bottles hung above him, and tubes were feeding into his arms. And but he depicted himself as awake and alert. And at the foot of the bed, Satan, with the horns and a red robe, said, he came to claim my soul, you know, but his guardian angel had come to dispel the devil, but the devil was quite stronger, he said, and he was just about to take his soul when his Savior, Jesus Christ, came and dispelled the devil, and Joe knew at that point that he was saved, and it left such a profound impression upon him. Then, even though he was a simple man, a laborer all of his life, he drew this painting, brought a picture of it to me, and I was so struck with the profundity of his experience that I kept that painting. In fact, I still have it today, you know, 30 years later.
And before you embark then on the mission and you're going through this with him, biologically or medically, what are you thinking, that there's something wrong with him, or he truly had this very mystical experience?
Well, at the time, I didn't know. You know, we know a lot more about the brain, and I know a lot more about the brain now than I did back then. But I knew the brain must be participating in some important way, and I wanted to find out, because this was so important to him. One of the things that really I've discovered since then is that the fact that Joe had actually told me about this experience is unusual in itself. I think many people have these experiences, and they are reluctant for one reason or another to bring it to their doctor's attention. So I felt really blessed that Joe really introduced this very profound experience to me.
But you weren't judgmental about him at all, it sounds like.
Oh, no, not at all. I firmly believe that Joe experienced it just as he had told me. I was not interested in explaining away the experience. I was very interested in understanding how the brain might participate in this experience. But no, I was very open to what Joe was experiencing.
Those, Kevin, who are truly spiritual will simply say, you do not need the brain to do this, that this happens outside of the physical realm. I assume you would say otherwise.
Well, I do say otherwise. You know, my belief system is firmly rooted in science. I believe that there's a lot that science can't tell us, and there's a lot very important things that science will never be able to tell us. But my belief system really is firmly embedded in science, and I think that we have many reasons to believe that the brain participates in these experiences, and I don't think we should be afraid of that, George. I think probably one good way of thinking about it is this. Faithful Christians believe that, the Apostle Matthew was divinely inspired when he wrote New Testament.
Right.
You know, and we have no reason to believe that at the time that Matthew was writing this, that he wasn't using the parts of the brain that we use in our everyday reading and writing. You know, and people, I think, are not troubled by that fact. He may be divinely inspired in why he wrote that, but it may have a divine basis.
And let me ask you this, Kevin, because that'll help us as we get through this tonight. Do you believe in life after death, or do you think that's merely an attached function of the brain?
I think the jury's still out on that, George. I mean, I think that life after death is a non-science question, and because science really can't answer that. Science can only address some questions, and questions that really science is too weak to understand, I think fall in the realm of faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I believe there's room in the brain for faith. I mean, I don't think the brain is the answer to everything. The brain and the science can tell us how the brain works in these experiences, you know, to a degree, but it can't tell us why it's doing this or what the meaning of these experiences truly are.
Because where I was going with this, if there is life after death and the physical body is gone, the brain no longer functions, what is working on that other side to keep that going?
Well, I don't think science can address that, George, and I'm not dispelling that.
No, I know.
Yeah, I think that's a question that falls within, you know, within the realm of an individual's faith, you know, and I think that, and in my exploration of these experiences, I've focused on how the brain was working. And so I really wanted to stay, you know, really tightly, you know, in focus on that point.
What are the borderlands of consciousness that you've talked about?
Well, this is a fascinating idea that I go in in the book. And there are actually two borderlands of consciousness that I write about. The first is unconsciousness and consciousness itself. If the brain is not getting enough blood flow, if there's a certain threshold of low flow to the brain, then unconsciousness will ensue. But oftentimes we don't go abruptly from consciousness to unconsciousness. We can fade into unconsciousness, and as we're fading into unconsciousness, we've really gone in sort of a borderline where we're not really fully conscious or unconscious. And a lot of things can happen in that borderland, and a lot of things do. What sometimes is not appreciated, certainly not appreciated by many doctors, is the fact that oftentimes people, if they faint or they're under cardiac arrest, or their heart is beating slowly, they may appear as if they're unconscious, but they can be a lot more alert and aware than anyone suspects. In fact, if someone faints, the eyes don't close. They actually remain open.
So they may be seeing what's going on.
They may be seeing, exactly, and hearing what's going on, but not be able to communicate that at the time.
I've long suspected sometimes, and what a nightmare this would be, Kevin, but people in comas, though they may not be able to react to people, may be fully aware of what's going on in the room. And, you know, it's like they're in a tomb, captured within their body.
Well, George, you're very, very much true, more than you can imagine. In fact, for years, I have instructed doctors who I've been training that you must understand that the patient in the ICU in coma can be very much aware of what's going on around them. You have to speak as if they can hear and understand, because they may very well. And so I drill that fact into the people that I'm, into the physicians that I'm training.
Let's talk a little bit about the near-death experience, and a little more than what we were just talking about. In your opinion, what's going on here?
Well, I think, George, I see it, you know, in a different way than many other people do, because I'm really looking at it from the vantage point of the brain. You know, I'm not looking at it from the vantage point of a cardiologist or a layperson. I think almost all of your listeners will have an appreciation for what the near-death experience is and the elements, including, you know, the tunnel, light, and perhaps seeing other persons live or dead, and then returning. And I think most people are aware of that. And I think most people are aware of that because I actually think near-death experiences are quite common. But from my standpoint, as a neurologist, near-death experience, which I think is the dominant spiritual experience of our time. But for me, it's first and foremost a crisis of consciousness. You know, we forget. You know, our brain is really a magnificent organ. You know, when we think of what the brain can do, Shakespeare's plays, Plato's philosophies, Einstein's theories, Beethoven's music, all these wonderful things that the brain creates, sort of blinds us, and dazzles us to the fact that the brain really, first and foremost, is to keep us alive. And if we are threatened, if the brain is threatened, then it triggers very ancient reactions. Life and death reactions, so that it can remain alive. Now, the brain is an unusual organ because, in many ways, but one of the ways is its energy requirements. It needs blood flow every second of life because it can only extract energy and oxygen from blood. If the brain doesn't get enough blood flow for 10 seconds or so, then unconsciousness will ensue. And so it really pays close attention to its blood supply. And then if its blood supply is threatened, either because we're fainting or because the heart is disturbed, then it kicks in these very ancient reflexes.
In the 30 years, and why did you keep at it for 30 years, Kevin? This is unbelievable.
Well, you know, it's Joe's experience left an indelible mark on me, and I realized how powerful that experience was because it really changed his life. You know, and a good physician can't ignore things which change people's lives for the better. That are that powerful. And so over the years, I collected as many experiences as I could find. Some of them were friends and some of them were patients. And I sort of tucked them away Until I got enough where, you know, I thought, you know, I need to start looking at these in a brain way, because frankly, George, neurologists had ignored it. You know, they really weren't interested in how the brain was participating in these kinds of experiences. And so one day, I will never forget, this is one of the most vibrant memories that I have. I decided I was at a point in my career where I could return and try to make sense of these stories. And I'm a very strong believer that someone has to go to the source of information. Now, that means you go ask the person themselves who had the experience, or if someone is writing on something, you go to the original book. You don't get someone else's ideas about that idea. And so I sat down reading the book of that really introduced the whole idea of near-death experience, and that's Raymond Moody's Life After Life.
That's right.
And it's a fascinating classic account. I must commend Dr. Moody for really bringing those narratives together. He really did a world of service to this area. But when I was reading these stories, I was reading them not as most people read them. I was really reading them really with the eye of a neurologist, or the neuroscientist, looking for how the brain might be working. And I will never forget one case. It was a lady, a Mrs. Martin, and she had had a cardiac arrest in the X-ray department. And she was lying on the gurney, and the radiologist thought she had died. And he thought she had died because he wasn't able to get a pulse, although she may have had one,
mm-hmm.
And she was paralyzed. And she recalls him going on the phone and telling her physician that, you know, geez, you know, doctor, I've killed your patient,
yeah.
Mrs. Martin. But what really hit me was that when she was telling Dr. Moody, she said, and I knew I wasn't dead. I tried to move or let them know, but I couldn't. And so I thought to myself, well, what natural process would produce paralysis? Because that's really a wonderful description of paralysis.
Yeah, it sure is.
And then it hit me. Maybe it's the process that each of us goes through every night, multiple times. And that's the REM consciousness. When we're dreaming, we're paralyzed. We can't move. And the body naturally becomes paralyzed and then releases that paralysis. And then I thought, whoa, it just sort of hit me like a lightning bolt. REM consciousness can explain so much of how the brain can be participating in the near-death experience.
When people in a near-death experience, Kevin, say they see the light at the tunnel, is that the brain creating that, or is there actually really a light out there?
Well, I don't think there can be both, actually. You know, remember when I said earlier that sometimes when people faint or their heart stops, that their eyes will remain open?
That's right. Hold on, Kevin. We're at this break already, but I want to come right back with you. Dr. Kevin Nelson, we're talking about his 30 years of research that he put in his book, The Spiritual Doorway in the Brain. We'll be back. And our special guest tonight, Dr. Kevin Nelson, we're talking about his 30-year-plus years of work, The Spiritual Doorway in the Brain. And we'll be back with Dr. Kevin Nelson in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Kevin Nelson. Kevin, whereabouts from Michigan were you? I was born in Detroit.
Oh, well, I was born on the other side of the state, within walking distance of Lake Michigan, about 200 miles north of Chicago, and actually a very... in the largest Dutch community outside of Holland, a place called Grand Haven.
Holland, though, the Tulip Festival.
Oh, yes, yes. It's a wonderful place. It really is.
Yeah, sure. It's a great state. Anyways, we were talking about light at the end of the tunnel. What are they actually seeing?
Well, let me back up a little bit, George, and explain why the light is important. The light is, of course, one of the premier experiences in near death for many people. The brain has only three states of consciousness to choose from. It can be awake, like most of us are right now. It can be asleep, and in sleep, there's what's called non-REM sleep, and there's REM sleep, okay, REM consciousness. Now, REM stands for rapid eye movement. And so the very state of consciousness is defined and characterized by activation of the visual system. In fact, during REM, there's electrical discharges coming up from the deep, most primitive parts of our brain that robustly activate our entire visual system. And so light is really the dominant sensation of REM consciousness. And I mean, I think most people would agree, certainly research has borne this out, that light vision is the dominant sense of our dreams. When we dream, most of our dream is composed of light and vision.
Okay.
And so if this system is activated, then, of course, its dominant sensation is also going to be activated, will be light. Now, in addition to that, as we spoke that with fainting or when the heart stops, the eyes are open. And so ambient light, that is that light that's around us, can also come in as well. But you're not, because the brain and the eyes, with the lack of blood flow, they're not going to be processing that light normally. So it won't appear to us in a normal way. So the light has two sources.
You've heard of out-of-body experiences,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yes.
Tell me the tie-in here with that.
Well, that's actually a fascinating story that was really underappreciated until I brought it to attention in my book, The Spiritual Doorway in the Brain. And I spent some time on that because I think many physicians were unaware of the very strong link of out-of-body experiences and REM consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've known for some time that the brain can be stimulated in certain regions, and it will immediately produce an out-of-body experience. In fact, this really goes back to the very earliest days of neurosurgery, when Dr. Penfield in Canada had stimulated the brain and induced an out-of-body experience right after the stimulation. But the refined understanding of this has come through the work of Dr. Ulf Blank in Switzerland. And what he found was that by putting a small amount of current, in fact, the amount of current that's a hundredth of what a 60-watt light bulb would otherwise draw. It's just a tiny amount of that trickle of a current in a region called the temporal parietal area. It's an area of the brain that resides basically just above the ear. It's probably the size of a quarter. And if you put that, if you stimulate that area, flip the switch, boom, someone's out of their body. Turn the switch off, boom, they're back in. Switch on, boom, they're out of their body. Switch off, boom, they're back in.
Huh. I mean,
really, at the flip of a switch, you can swing someone in and out of their body. In other words, the perception that they're in another body. Well, that temporal parietal area that Dr. Blank was stimulating is the very same area that is turned off during REM consciousness. Many people don't understand, who aren't familiar with the brain, that oftentimes turning a part of the brain off is as important as it is to turn it on. And so turning that part of the brain off can cause out-of-body experiences.
Now, when they have these out-of-body experiences, where they claim that they can see, let's assume they're in a hospital room, they can see the nurses and doctors running around. They can tell the nurses and doctors what they're saying, but they're looking down at their body. So how does that explain that?
The temporal parietal area is sort of a junction point. It's sort of like Grand Central Station for our senses. It brings in a sense of motion, where our body is in space. That's the inner ear, the vestibular section. It brings in the feeling parts. You know, if I know where my right foot is right now, it brings that part of sensation together, and it brings in the vision part. So it's sort of it integrates, it brings all those sensations together to give us an idea of where we are in space. Now, undoubtedly, during an out-of-body experience, people are hearing what's going on around them, but they're not processing all those sensations in the same way. They're not matching their vision with their other body sensations, and so this mismatch is what creates the out-of-body experience. Now, we know this actually happens a lot in REM consciousness. For example, narcoleptics who have a faulty switch that are oftentimes blending REM consciousness and waking consciousness.
This is the ability to just fall asleep right there at your desk, right?
Yeah, it's the suffering of falling asleep.
The suffering.
You know, yes.
They're not doing it on purpose.
Oh, no. They frequently will collapse because they'll have the paralysis of REM consciousness. It will hit them suddenly. They'll fall asleep in the REM consciousness.
Can it happen, Kevin, while they're walking?
Yes, it can. It can happen while they're walking, while they're doing something. They can have collapse, what we call cataplexy, where the paralysis will hit them suddenly and cause them to fall. And oftentimes that's brought on by a startle or someone laughing. It's sort of akin to, you know, how we all are. You know, someone's tickling us mercilessly, and we feel helpless and weak. And
it actually hurts.
Yes,
you know, it does.
Yeah, but you can't move. You're weak. It's that kind of weakness that washes over them in spells, and it's really quite a disabling illness for some of them. In my book, I chronicle the life of. Matt, one of my research subjects, who is really plagued with just constant attacks of narcolepsy, hallucinations. He has frequent out-of-body experiences, it's really quite a disturbing condition for him. But, you know, George, one of the things that I think people don't appreciate is not only the strong connection of out-of-body experiences with REM consciousness, but how common out-of-body experiences are. One out of 20 people in the world has had an out-of-body experience.
Now, but what is your definition of an out-of-body experience?
Well, generally, they almost always happen, not exclusively, but the vast majority happen when someone is lying down, and they will feel a sense of levitation that they've left their body. They may or may not see their body to look back and actually.
All right. How do you explain that if they see their body?
Well, they have a memory of their body, and what's happened is that our memories get integrated in that area of the temporal parietal area that I mentioned earlier. You know, that brings memories are one of the things that is brought together with our sense of motion, our sense of where we are in space, and vision. And so some people can see their bodies, others will actually see the surroundings at a different vantage. They may be up in the corner of the room, or they may be up against the window. And so it can vary from person to person. And within us, a person who has multiple out-of-body experiences, it can actually vary from episode to episode.
Okay, so at this point, you're not saying that there's a real subconscious separation from the body.
No, I'm not. And one of the things that I must make clear as a scientist is that there is no scientific evidence to date that indicates that consciousness can exist outside the brain. I'd be fascinated and in many ways hope it happens. You know, it can happen. But from a strictly scientific standpoint, there hasn't been the verification of consciousness outside the brain.
Did you come across in your research anybody who had the ability to perform telepathy, people who had incredible intuitiveness or anything like that?
Yeah, at the time of their experience they had, but not so much afterwards, although I would say that we have several who had found their intuition was honed, you know, seemed a little sharper of things that were going to happen, that they had a bit more premonitions that something would happen. So we did certainly have that kind of thing.
Tell us about the Lila and Jack, one of your stories in your book.
Oh yeah, this was actually very instructive and came a real surprise to me. Lila's my sister-in-law, and she knew I was collecting these stories, and she said, "Well, I got to tell you about my father's near-death experience." And she said that her father had a cardiac arrest while on the operating table, and had a very what people would say is a traditional near-death experience with the light and an out-of-body experience. And of course, he recovered from that, and he remained quite ill. But during the rest of his life, it really invigorated him in important ways. He really decided to live life as robustly as he possibly could. But more importantly, he lost his fear of death. You know, he realized that passing from this world to the next is not going to be a painful and horrifying experience, but really one of peace, the kind of peace that he experienced in his near-death experience. And it not only gave him comfort, but it gave my sister-in-law comfort as well. And there was very reassuring for both of them, and they felt really blessed that he'd had this experience. And it really, I think, really brings home the most important point, is that the most important aspect of these experiences is how they affect us, how they change our lives, because they are transforming in many ways for many people.
Well, that is true. Now, you call the book The Spiritual Doorway in the Brain. How come?
Well, I think that people reach a spiritual essence in many different ways, and the brain participates in that in different ways. I of course focus on near-death experience for a couple of reasons. And one is, of course, is that I think they're very common, and in many ways, near-death experience is the dominant spiritual experience of our time. You know, it's how we touch what we consider to be divine. And so it was only natural that, you know, I spend a great deal of time discussing that. Plus, it was the source of my research as well. But I think the brain participates in spiritual experience in other ways as well. And I do think that that parts of the brain, of course, are critically important to our spiritual experiences.
Maybe so. The name of the book, The Spiritual Doorway in the Brain by Dr. Kevin Nelson. We're going to talk about intelligent design and see how that fits in next hour as well. Plus, we'll take your stories and your phone calls. What would you like our listeners to come away with after reading this?
Well, I think one of the most important things for your listeners is that, first off, I really am making the brain accessible to people. I think that's very, very important. I think it's important that they understand that the brain does participate in spiritual experience, but it's really in this book, it's through the people's stories that I portray, that we can see that spiritual experience is really bound to our primal brain. Even if we knew what every brain molecule is doing during these experiences, the mystery of spirituality will always be with us. But I think it's important that we understand as best we can how the brain helps us have these experiences.
You yourself had an interesting experience, didn't you?
Well, Yes, I did. Are you referring to my ESP-like experience?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a very powerful experience for me. And I'll tell you, George, I think that was formative in opening my eyes to unusual experiences that people can have and that how powerful and influential they are. This happened when I was a teenager, and like many teenagers, I was adventurous and did foolish things. And on one boring afternoon, a bunch of my buddies and I decided we'd try to make ourselves faint. Now, this is a common teenage prank, which, by the way, I must very clearly say that this can go awry. And in fact, there have been deaths from people who have hung themselves for trying to make themselves faint. But we did not do it in such a manner. We sat down and hyperventilated and stood up quickly to induce the faint. And it turned out I was pretty good at it. And in one of my faints, in fact, the only one I actually had, I had a vision. I had a very vivid vision of my father calling out my name in an angry fashion from our doorway. And so when I came to, I was very agitated and disturbed, and I quickly ran home, and sure enough, he was there at the door and calling out for me. And there was no way I could have heard that where I was at. And I always felt like I'd had some kind of connection, that something had brought that communication to me.
Let's get into that, Kevin, when we come back in a moment, because there might be more to this than meets the brain. We'll be back.